Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Drexel.
And today on the pod, we are focusing pretty deeply on foreign policy, which we don't
favorite.
Usually do. I know. We are going to be talking about what happened in Syria over the weekend and then this escalating trade war with China.
But we're not in a trade war.
Not yet.
Right. According to the president.
That's fair.
Yeah.
And technically.
But we are.
Yeah. It is escalating quickly. And our very own Varsha is actually getting her PhD in foreign policy. So she helped us sort of think through what exactly is going on. So if you would like to know more about all of this, reach out to her on Twitter because she's very, very smart.
Yeah, I was reading through the outline last night and I was like, oh.
Yeah.
14 pages. That's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's great.
Yeah, it's really great. So what did you do this weekend, Drexel?
I had an event this weekend because that's my life. And then Tim and I did our cake tasting.
That's so exciting.
With our friend Maeve Rochford, who won the Holiday Baking Champion on the Food Network.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so she's going to be doing our cake. And so we thought we were going to go with one particular flavor. We thought we were going to go with red velvet, but we ended up going with something very different that we would not have expected.
So what are you going with?
I can't. You'll have to find out when you get there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No special
it's all,
privileges.
It's all a secret. It's G14 classified. But yeah, so we're doing two-tier and then 100 cupcakes. So
that's awesome.
It's gonna be a lot of fun. And then we had a 2-hour walkthrough at our venue.
Oh, yesterday. That's a long walk.
It was a long time. I didn't think it was gonna be that. I didn't think it was gonna take that long. But like it was like me and the coordinator and then the florist with Tim, and so it was all happening at the same time. And so it's a lot of work.
Yeah, that is a lot of work.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, we're just a few days away.
That's
by days, I mean a few weeks.
That's exciting, though. Yeah. I can't wait.
Yeah. What about you?
I'm going to talk about this in my gratitude check because it was so cool. But I went to a space party.
I saw that.
At the California Science Center.
With your Uhura outfit.
Yes. I was very, it was space themed. And so we were encouraged to dress spacey. And I did. I have a gold leather dress from my party days that I put back on.
Last year.
Yeah, last year. My party days 1 year ago. Yeah.
Before Trump became
president. Before Trump became president. Yeah. And it was really fun. So I want to talk a little bit more about that. My gratitude check. And yeah, I don't know. I had a really great weekend. A lot of fun.
That's good.
If you've listened to this show before, you've heard me talk about Framebridge. You know they make it super easy and affordable to custom frame your favorite things, from print and posters to the photos on your phone. But did you also know that a custom framed photo from Framebridge makes the perfect Mother's Day gift? It is ridiculously easy. You can order in a few minutes, and Framebridge will send one-of-a-kind framed picture that your mom will love. The perfect gift for your mom is probably already on your phone. You just go to framebridge.com, pick a great photo, and then the expert team at Framebridge will frame it and send it straight to you. Or they can deliver it straight to your mom in time for Mother's Day, for those of you like me who procrastinate every single time. The amazing team at Framebridge will expertly frame your item in days, not weeks or months, and deliver your finished gift ready to hang. And for me, I know that my mother-in-law is very difficult to shop for. And so this year, I had a few pictures of the whole family printed and framed for her, and they are spectacular. They were so good, I actually went back and did one for myself as well. So happy Mother's Day to me. So order a custom gift for any mom in your life right from your phone. Go to framebridge.com and use the promo code HELLBENT to save 15% off your first order. That's framebridge.com, promo code HELLBENT. Framebridge.com with promo code HELLBENT for 15% off.
All right, Devin, let's get into some listener feedback from last week.
Yes. So Laura tweeted in response to on Thursday's episode, I talked to Christina Reynolds, who is the VP of communications at Emily's List. And in conjunction with that episode, I took a couple of clips from past episodes talking when I talked to women about their runs for Congress and the sexism and misogyny that they've experienced on the campaign trail to sort of put what Emily's List is doing in larger context. And one thing that almost all of the women talk about is the fact that they experience a lot of misogyny, but they've, for the most part, grown a thick skin against it. And how that answer has always sort of rubbed me the right way, or rubbed me the wrong way. I understand why you would do that. It's just, it's frustrating that that's still what we have to do in 2018. So Laura tweeted in response to this, she said, quote, "I'm a 35-year-old female, always worked in male-dominated industries and raised in the South. And since the election, I've noticed how thick my skin is and rage at that necessity, that that necessity has grown. But it gives additional perspective to others' plights, i.e. POC, people of color, LGBTQ, et cetera. Thank you for this pod and these stories." So I think that is true, is, you know, it's frustrating that we have to have this thick skin as women, but that's only one teeny tiny piece of what people are going through, not just since this election, but since the inception of our country. So I think it was it's a very good point putting in that kind of perspective.
I think she brings up a good point. I think when you talk about, you know, when we talked about immigration a long time ago, we talked a lot about how sometimes we only think about one race. Right. We're always thinking about those that are coming from our southern border, and not thinking about, you know, if you're coming from England or if you come from Australia or if you come from Canada, they're all immigrants coming over. Some of our bigger allies, and the same thing I think goes for marginalized people of color and LGBTQ. And people think when they talk about equality, especially right now, you know, you could either go civil rights in terms of African Americans and you know, police brutality and all that, or you can talk about, you're not talking about all of them together,
right?
You know, whether we're talking about LGBTQ issues or we're talking about women's rights. So I think sometimes we forget that the other groups are going through something similar. And so we have to start to talk about them all
intersectionally
at the same time. And yeah. I know a lot of people do that. And I think we just got to get better at making sure that we're talking about, you know, we do say, you know, people on the campaign trail talk about equal rights across the board a lot, but don't explain that enough,
right,
to where constituents and voters actually understand that.
Right. So we have a huge guest announcement for Thursday.
What is it?
Okay. So normally we don't announce on the show and we do early announcements on our Patreon, but I'm so excited because on Thursday we have Cecile Richards on the show.
That's amazing.
I know. So she's the recently retired president of Planned Parenthood and general fucking badass. And she's coming on to talk about her new book, Make Trouble. And that sound you hear is me shitting my pants.
I see it. It's oozing.
It's that's really descriptive. Thank you.
I just wanted to put that into the listener context.
Yeah. I mean, and I just on a more personal context, like personal note, it has been a whirlwind year. And if you had told me a year ago that I would be interviewing one of my personal heroes for this show, I would have pointed and laughed at you. So, I mean, thank you for coming on this journey with us.
I'm excited. I feel like
so good.
You know, Nemo in the Slumberland. Do you remember that movie?
No.
Oh. It was great. He was on a bed and he flew around in Dreamland and stuff like that. But I'm on that journey with you.
Yeah. And then I actually have a really exciting update on Sarah's health. So she texted me yesterday, which in and of itself is big news. It's been months since we've been able to communicate regularly. And she said that she's feeling much better and she's bullish, but cautiously optimistic. She's still up in the Bay with her family, which has improved her mental health, and she's seeing good doctors and feeling good. And she told me that this is the best that she's felt in about 8 months. So I am really encouraged by this news because I miss her just as much as you do.
I do.
Fellow Hellions. Hopefully we'll get her back soon. You know, she really wants to come back. She's like, this is what I want to do. And it's frustrating that I can't do it. And also bonus because, you know, when she does come back, you still get Drexel's sweet, sweet announcer voice on Bleep What You Heard.
Oh my goodness. That's so funny. Yeah.
So, you know, we don't have a timeline for Sarah's return, but my relentlessly optimistic heart is encouraged.
It's going to be good to have her back.
Yeah.
One thing I also wanted to point out was that we are no longer in competition on Mondays with Pod Saves America because they've moved to Tuesdays. So we are your Monday podcast.
All right, Drexel, let's jump into our first news block. We are going to talk about Syria and China. So let's start with Syria. Can you tell us what happened on Saturday?
Sure. So Saturday, innocent Syrians were hit with another chemical attack. This isn't the first time that we've seen it, especially several times during the Obama administration. Syria's leader Bashar al-Assad and Russia are suspected to be behind the attacks. Both countries are blaming Israel for the incident. Syria and its most powerful ally, Russia, blamed Israel for striking an airbase in the war-torn country on Monday following a suspected chemical gas attack that drew condemnation from the world powers. They said that there are about 14 dead, though more casualties are expected, whereas a result from a missile launched by the alleged Israel,
right,
into the T4 military base,
which is in the area.
Israel rarely acknowledges carrying out strikes, but has admitted attacking targets in Syria dozens of times since 2012. Its heaviest airstrike on Syria in February of this year included targeting the T4 air base.
Right. So it's interesting because this attack came as Syrian rebel forces were on the verge of reclaiming Douma, which is the last town held by rebels. And it's been under siege for about 6 years from the Syrian government. And Russia is actually also saying that there's no evidence that a chemical attack even took place.
Right, which has been their position for a while as Vladimir Putin continues to protect Bashar al-Assad and all the chemical attacks that have happened on the Syrian people ever since he carried those out. And somehow Bashar al-Assad is still in power.
Right.
So this is not surprising from the Russians, because if they continue to say that there's no chemical attack that's happening, then they can't link back to all the times that they said before that there was no, that, you know, Bashar al-Assad was not gassing his own people.
Right.
So this is just, you know, stay the course rhetoric from Russia so that they can continue to maintain that front.
Right. Well, and this sort of denial is just so blatant in the face of facts. Because according to CNN, the Syrian American Medical Society said that more than 500 people were brought to a medical centers in Douma. And they had indications that they had been exposed to a chemical agent, including breathing difficulties, bluish skin, mouth foaming, chemical burns, and the emission of a chlorine-like odor. So the estimates of how many have died are between 42 and 60, but those numbers could rise, as, you know, chemical attacks don't kill evenly, and they also are still looking for people in basements where hundreds of families sought refuge.
What's really interesting is that what we know from Israel's attacks, especially in their conflict with Palestine, is that they really don't use chemical weapons often or at all. You know, that's a whole nother topic on the Israel-Palestine conflict. But for them to use chemical weapons on Syria, to me, doesn't add up to the way that they have attacked in the past.
Right.
And so, yes, airstrikes, and they've admitted to certain airstrikes on Syria, but using the use of chemical weapons does not seem, right, or as far as I know, does not seem something that they have used in the past. So, but at the same time, we know that Bashar al-Assad has used chemical weapons. So maybe there's a good chance that, and this is just hypothetical and I'm just, you know, shooting the shit, but like, it's possible that Israel attacked Syria through via airstrikes, right, which gave Bashar al-Assad an opportunity to use chemical weapons and then blame it on Israel, right, at the same time. I mean, that's some Hardy Boy shit, but, right, you know,
yeah,
you know, but like that could make that in 2018 makes more sense than Israel going out of their way to use chemical weapons on the Syrian people.
To what end, really? I also want to talk a little bit about the timing of this attack on, you know, innocent Syrians. Trump made comments last week about pulling out troops from Syria. He said that in the last 17 years, we've spent about $7 trillion on the war in the Middle East, and that we are getting, quote, nothing in return. And I just want to take a quick aside here and point out the fact that if he doesn't like the amount of money we've spent on this war, why brag about increasing the military's budget?
Because it's red meat for the voters, right, because everybody wants to support troops, which, yeah, great, right, you know, but support the troops not in terms of weaponry, support, right, their families,
right,
and maybe beef up the VA budget,
yeah,
a little more. So I think that Republicans want to help out their defense contracts friends, as well, and Democrats too for the most part, and want to claim that they are the party that will continue to give the military what they need. But right, what we've seen in the past is that there have been plenty of times under the Obama administration, under the Trump administration, the Bush administration, where the military has come back and said, we don't need
this much
money. Stuff.
Right.
And so Trump wants to be that guy to be like, I'm keeping the military tough.
Right.
Well, you keep the military tough by supporting their families.
Well, and this goes back to this paternalistic toxic masculinity that Trump has used not only in campaigning but, you know, in his American Carnage speech from his inauguration. This idea that we need to be tough in this very traditionally masculine way to take care of ourselves domestically. I don't know. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that voters are starting to see, especially those who believe that he is a strong supporter of the military, starts to see how he treats the generals that have worked for,
right,
him. General Kelly, General McMaster, for the most part. I would say that Secretary Mattis is a little bit different because he hasn't been embroiled in some sort,
right,
of problem.
Right.
And defense is just so... like, yeah, that's a huge part of the commander-in-chief's role. But I think General McMaster generally has not been an issue, or he's just stayed so far away from,
right,
the White House that he's just like, I'm out of it. Yeah.
You know, Trump made these comments about pulling troops out of Syria, and then the White House actually had to walk those comments back.
Of course they
saying
did.
That, you know, the generals were saying there's no timeline to do so, there's no plan to do so. And I think even Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, you know, we will stay there until ISIS is defeated. And that's the White House's official stance. And all of this comes after years of Trump mocking presidents and the military for telegraphing their moves. And he said that he would never do that. And he's going to keep everything a secret. And then he goes out and stands on some podium somewhere and says, we're going to pull out of Syria.
Yeah, I think it's one thing, and of course presidents have talked about it in the past. It's one thing to say something on the campaign trail, but until you're actually in the office, then you really don't know. And I think Trump is starting to realize that piece,
right,
of it, because I think there are some, like, look, when President Obama was running for office, he talked about pulling troops out of Iraq. And for the most part, he did, mm-hmm, that piece of it. And so it's not new. Pulling,
right,
out of Syria, okay, just pull them out of Syria and move them,
right,
to bases that make more sense in that region. So I think that pulling the troops out of Syria should not bother people. The decision to do that, because that is within the purview of the commander in chief. I think, you know, and when it comes to, like, Trump's going to say what he's going to say and do that. I just think that he just needs to make sure that he's continuing to put the pressure on, more pressure on Russia to talk about these Syria chemical weapons pieces.
Right. And I mean, look, I'm no war hawk. I don't want us to be in this war. I want our troops to come home. But I think, you know, this idea of nation building and staying in areas in which we have come in and ravaged to rebuild those countries has kind of fallen out of favor in a way. And that we feel like we can just get the fuck out of there, which I'm not saying I want our troops over there. I don't. But I think that this sort of policymaking where he stands on some random podium when he's supposed to be talking about something completely different and just diarrheaing out of his mouth for an hour about pulling troops out of Russia, I mean, or pulling troops out of Syria, I think that's just irresponsible.
But it also comes down to a moral issue. And Hillary Clinton talked about it on the campaign trail, or at least in an article that I read, where she talked, or after the election, where she talked about foreign policy from a moral standpoint. We know that Trump has no morals.
Right.
So he wants to get something out of it. That's what he really cares about. Right. He doesn't care about
wartime presidents
the
are
building
popular.
Of it. I won't say that President Bush ever went around saying we got to get something out of it.
Right.
I think he was always from a moral standpoint and looking at it from a lens of democracy, which he talks about a lot, but he never went out and said, we're not getting something from the other countries. We expect to be getting something out from that.
Well, that's the other weird comments he's made in the past. Like, we're not getting anything out of it. We didn't take their oil, which is what is it? Plundering? What, that's not something that you do.
Right. We're not pirates.
We're not fucking pirates. Thank you. And it just, the rhetoric Trump uses around war is concerning. Absolute very least.
And he doesn't know what he's talking about.
He doesn't know what he's talking about. And he refuses to listen to the people who do know what they're talking about. And so McCain had criticism of this, actually. And McCain, again, is a very interesting figure, I think, in the Republican Party. He gets a lot of credit for being a maverick and, being a charismatic dissenter and solving all these problems when he just lets female Republicans do all the work and then he takes all the credit. But he did say this, quote, President Trump last week signaled to the world that the United States would prematurely withdraw from Syria. Bashar al-Assad and his Russian and Iranian backers have heard him, and emboldened by American inaction, Assad has reportedly launched another chemical attack against innocent men, women, and children, this time in Douma. So he's saying that the timing is not a coincidence, that this chemical attack occurred right after we said that we'd be pulling out of Syria, and that's no coincidence. Though I was listening to NPR this morning, and Robert Ford, who was the U.S. ambassador to Syria under President Obama, said that while that's possible, Assad uses chemical weapons on his citizens regularly, and that the timing may or may not be coincidental. And he also says that we do need to strike back militarily for this, and not just a one-time strike. You know, Assad needs to pay a military price, according to Ford, and that because if you just do it once, Assad will stop for a little while, weeks, months, whatever, and then go back. So a sustained campaign, which again is a nice way to say a war, maybe not a ground war, but a war nonetheless, is what we need to combat this sort of use of chemical weapons in Syria.
Yeah, I'm going back to what you were talking about with John McCain. I'd be interested to see what the female senators who were in the military, because like you said, we spend a lot of time listening to what John McCain has to say. And I'd be interested to see how some of our wartime female senators, Tammy Duckworth and Joni Ernst, really feel about that. I know Tammy Duckworth came out with a statement really condemning the attacks, not really talking about the president's response.
And it's interesting because actually almost exactly 1 year ago, April 2017, Syria launched a chemical attack that Trump responded by sending missiles to a base in Syria. But then he took no further action. And this kind of goes back to what Ambassador Ford was saying, that a one-time airstrike might stop Assad for a period, but that if we really want to end this, it needs to be a sustained conflict, which again is a nice way to say war.
Yeah, I think this whole section we're talking about is all about timing, and I think it's very interesting. Of course, a year ago, Donald Trump had been in office for 4 months at that point, and he was very complimentary of Russia.
Yes.
I think now that we are in the thick of, there have been a lot of changes to how the White House has responded to Russia, expelling diplomats and doing all those things, where Donald Trump now feels like, because the pressure is coming from the Mueller investigation, that he has slightly changed the way that he talks about Russia, but not necessarily Vladimir Putin, and the White House's stances on that. And so, yeah, of course he'd go out of his way to start to put the pressure in ways that he wouldn't a year ago.
Right.
So, and that's significant to compare, you know, as you compared last year's to this year.
Right. And I just want to say, on a personal note, I had a really, I mean, obviously everyone has a very difficult time with these kind of stories, but I actually didn't do this section until this morning. The section on Syria, even though the attack happened on Saturday and I had plenty of time to do it on Sunday. But seeing pictures of toddlers, of children in gas masks, and looking at pictures of people dead by their own government, it is days like this where I want to quit and just pack it up and go back to what I was doing 18 months ago, 2 years ago, which was absolutely fucking nothing. And I would have had no idea that there was a chemical attack in Syria. I would have been one of those people that would have lived my life never knowing that. And, you know, the profound privilege that comes with being able to ignore something like that is something that I'm reckoning with. But even so, it's a hard story, and I can't hold it in my mind for too long, because there's just something so inherently wrong with what is going on that I can't even get worked up over Trump's response or lack of response, because there's something very defeating about stories like this. And they're very hard to cover, and they're very hard to read. And I think that we as a country need to start reckoning with the fact that, like you said, we need to start taking a more moral approach to this. And it's really easy to sanitize this. But the fact of the matter is their number, 42 to 60 people, you know, 500 people at a medical center. I mean, it's very easy to decontextualize that. But it's something that we need to talk about. Again, we focus on domestic policy on this show for the most part, and there are plenty of problems here that we need to take care of. There are plenty of babies here that need to be taken care of. And I guess I just wanted to add my own personal commentary on how difficult this is and how much it sucks to be covering politics today.
Yeah, it's definitely politics as a whole, whether or not you're, you know, I think one of the good things about shows like this and as we continue to build the new show is about letting you guys, the listeners out there, really be able to take information that you might not have otherwise heard somewhere. Because, yeah, the news is not going to cover attacks like this in a way that we see, you know, photos, unless you're looking on Al Jazeera or more form news organizations, because Americans react first and think second. So our way of dealing with something will be like, we got to do something. We have to attack them.
Right.
That was never the position of the Obama administration. It was, we need to figure it out. We need to isolate them and then do what we can without casualty.
Right.
Whereas if we saw these photos of children and families being affected, our first response would be, we have to physically or militarily take out the person that has done this or that we think has done this. But in this case, with this situation, we don't know who's behind this attack. Right. Just like we said, it could be Syria who's using Israel as a cover.
Right.
But Israel probably did do something.
Right.
And Russia probably was behind the whole thing, you know, pulling the purse strings. So, I think that, you know, coming from a military family, I don't know that these, it's hard because I don't know that these stories affect me as much as they should, because I've just kind of seen it. But it does affect on a level of yeah, we gotta do something from a moral standpoint while protecting America at the same time.
Right. I guess maybe that's why, again, getting riled up about Trump's response, it's more just I don't expect much.
Right.
And I don't expect this administration to have any sort of strategy or heart or understanding of any kind. Yeah.
I think that eventually going forward, at least I'm going to try to not necessarily take what Trump says,
right,
but take the White House's response.
Right.
Because that's, while Trump's response is official record,
right,
at the end of the day, the policy is what the White House's response is.
Right.
So I think that as we continue to start to listen to these stories and look at Trump's comments, because he has no idea what he's talking about,
right,
take a step back and look at what the White House's response is, because that will be what they go forward
right
with.
Not what they're saying, what they're actually
what
doing.
They're actually doing.
Yeah. So, and I also just wanted to bring that up because I feel like one of the strengths of our show and shows like this, and the new way, the new political, more women getting involved, is something I talked about with Christina Reynolds, is that vulnerability and the sort of emotional side of this that's often drained from these situations. We don't, you know, we've always thought, you know, in a very masculine, we want, there's no crying in politics, no crying in baseball, right? And I think that I want to take steps to change that, because I think that that is absolutely an asset going forward. And if we're going to change the political landscape, if Trump is the logical end of the Republican Party and this toxic masculinity wrapped up in politics, then the only way to dismantle that is to do something completely different. And so, I mean, I think emotional vulnerability is going to be a large part of that.
I'd like to definitely see a lot more Congress people take that up. Not necessarily the commander in chief right now.
Maybe not.
But I would like to see Congress people like going out into town halls and talking to their constituents, not only about that. I think they have to do twofold things. I think I saw an article this weekend that said that areas that did not have access to news as much voted for Donald Trump. And I think a lot of these Congress people, especially Democratic candidates, have got to go out and say, let's talk about both what's happening here and reasons why we do things abroad. And here's what we're going to do about it.
Yeah.
And here's why.
Yeah,
because I think that Republicans, for the most part, they, especially the religious ones, they really do care about the morality of the country. And if we start to put into context for them what foreign policy means from a moral standpoint, I think Democrats have an upper hand on that.
Right. Okay, Drexel, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we are going to talk about China. I think by now everyone knows how hard it is for me to feed myself while I'm working. Enter Daily Harvest. They deliver perfectly portioned, frozen superfood eats straight to your door with your choice of smoothies, soups, breakfast bowls, or plant-based sundaes. I literally just made myself a smoothie for lunch. They are ready in literally 30 seconds. I take a cup out of the freezer and add water or almond milk if I'm feeling fancy, / if I actually went to the grocery store this week. I did this week, so I actually put almond milk in it. And then I blend it. Literally done, and it's delicious. I have no excuse to skip lunch, even when I'm feeling particularly drawn to the bag of chips I usually have while sitting at my desk. So go to daily-harvest.com and enter promo code HELLBENT to get 3 items free in your first box. That's promo code HELLBENT for 3 free Daily Harvest cups at daily-harvest.com. daily-harvest.com with promo code HELLBENT. So let's move on. Let's talk about China. What has been going on with trade policy? Because it's actually larger than China. China is sort of been escalating in the last week and a half or so. But this actually goes back to, I would say, the beginning of March, when Trump announced tariffs on aluminum and steel.
Yeah, China is playing chess.
Yes.
And Trump is playing checkers.
That's being very generous to Trump.
They're playing very different games, yeah. But China's very good at it.
Right.
Before we talk about the situation, I just want to talk about what a tariff actually is.
Oh, great idea.
Which is a tax or duty to be paid on a particular class of imports. So every time that we get something, we have to pay. Every time the United States gets something from China or wherever, we have to pay a tax on that to get that, and vice versa.
Right. So basically, if I buy $10 worth of something from China and there's a 25% tariff on it, I would have to pay
a lot of money.
I would have to pay $12.50 for that
item. I'm not a mathematician. I'm a political science. I was a political science major. We don't do math in politics. We let somebody else do that.
We hire pollsters
and accountants for that. So China, like we said, and the U.S. are threatening to impose massive tariffs on each other in an escalating game of chicken. And
yes,
it could end up hurting President Trump and the GOP in the ballot box, especially in some of the more flyover states. The farming industry in particular is going to take a massive hit. Tuesday of last week, the Trump administration announced a list of more than 1,300 Chinese exports, including toys, electronics, shoes, clothing, and furniture. So if you are shopping at Uniqlo,
right,
we're going to have a problem. that it plans to hit with 25% tariffs or border taxes. The tariffs are intended to punish Beijing for restricting U.S. investment in China, probably Trump Towers,
right,
and stealing American intellectual property, which we have not. Every time Trump has gone out and said they've stolen intellectual property, I'm like, well, prove that.
Yeah.
Like, say that out loud so that
give
we understand
something.
That.
Right.
Are they stealing our Apple iPhone? Nope, because they built it.
Right. Well, it's interesting because this goes back to the education aspect of this and understanding foreign policy, which is inherently very complicated. And I'm not saying that I have a great grasp on it, but a basic understanding of what a tariff is, what it would mean to steal intellectual property, why a sanction would be necessary. I mean, these are things that we can explain. We just don't.
Right. And I think that when you start to listen to the new show, when it comes out, that's what you're going to get. About that.
Yes.
In a little bit more in depth. But combined would affect about $50 billion worth of Chinese exports.
Right.
But so China was like, you know what? I see your 50 and I'll raise you 100.
Right, right. So basically China's like, fuck you, right? We're gonna do the same thing then. But what's interesting is Trump has not actually implemented any of these tariffs. This is not actually policy. This is Trump blowing smoke out of his butthole. And this goes back to one of the main issues with Trump. And again, not looking at what he says, but looking at what the White House actually does, because he's saying all this and he's just stirring passions. He's just stirring shit stirring without actually doing anything.
And it goes back to why I think that Democrats have got to go out and say, we've got to put the pressure on Donald Trump and say, okay, this is what you said. This is what your White House is doing. And then remind the American people, hey, this is what the president has said he's going to do and has yet to follow through on that.
Right.
So Democrats have to toe that line between explaining and pushing Trump to do what he says he's going to do.
Right.
Because we know that if he pushes this, then the proposed package that China's coming back with could affect more than 100 American-made products, including cars. So Detroit and all those places that we make cars in are going to get hit. Airplanes, so Boeing's going to take a hit.
Right.
And all those places. And soybeans. So all of our farmers are going to take a massive hit, which is the top U.S. agricultural export in China combined. They would cover about $50 billion worth of U.S. Exports, perfectly mirroring what we would have.
Right. And it's also interesting because there would also be Chinese tariffs on corn. And corn crops, in particular, would hit swing states in the Midwest like Illinois.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of corn farming in Illinois. So, you know, the strategy behind this is not there. And so, like I said, this goes back to the beginning of March when Trump announced tariffs on steel and aluminum. And he made no exceptions for close allies like Mexico, Canada, Britain, Germany. He was just like, nope, everyone.
But then he said that. But then the White House came back and said, we are going to we're going to actually exempt some of these
people. We're going to exempt Mexico and Canada.
These people that we said.
Right.
I'd be interested to know if you think that Beijing is also trying to play three-dimensional chess in the sense that they're looking at 2018 as well.
Right.
Because if they hit Trump's bread and butter farming, then it's going to hurt Republicans at the ballot box.
Right.
And then it's going to weaken this president even more.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you think Beijing is looking at it not only from their economical standpoint, but also their power standpoint,
right?
Especially if they weaken the president, because then they know that once Democrats get in power, this presidency is pretty much done
cooked
until 2020.
Right. Well, I think that there is, with all of these foreign policies like trade, tariffs, all of these are larger geopolitical moves for global power, and there's always been this sort of fear that China would overtake the United States as the most powerful economic power in the world. And so I think if you know, in my opinion, my humble opinion, which I'm no Varsha, so take it with a grain of salt, I think that China would be looking to weaken this presidency, not just to get better trade deals, but also because the weaker America gets, the more of a power vacuum there is for China to fill.
And then China and Russia go into a power struggle, and then we're in trouble.
Right, exactly. So these policies have broader ramifications than just starting a trade war with China, which Trump's like, trade wars are very easy to win.
This isn't trading spaces.
Right? This isn't some weird-ass beach thing that one of the... Do you remember that on Trading Spaces where...
Which
she made,
I watched
like a beach
this weekend.
Yeah, it was really good.
Did you? I only watched the reunion. I haven't watched the new episode yet.
It's really good.
Yeah.
This is just absolutely... this is... Trump is hitting way above his pay grade and does not know what the fuck he's doing. Because from April 1st to April 6th, all the U.S. and China did was go back and forth and threatening to hit each other with these huge, ridiculous tariffs. That's all they did.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the rhetoric between Trump and North Korea, except China's just a little bit more powerful.
Right.
And we owe them a lot of money.
Right, exactly.
We don't owe North Korea anything, but we definitely owe China. And I think that's part of the other reason why Trump hasn't really imposed, the White House really hasn't imposed, because China would be like, remember all that money that you owe us?
Right.
Let's talk about that.
Exactly.
Let's deal with that.
Right. And also, China could also go to the World Trade Organization and their dispute settlement process. So and Trump just doesn't seem to care. He just doesn't. He's like, I don't even know what that is. So I don't understand your question and I won't respond to it.
Yeah. But I think we should care because, of course, like we have been saying, this could turn into a huge trade war that would affect Americans significantly, not only farmers and their families, but us as
consumers.
So it just means in the future, fewer and fewer countries will trust us when we make deals. Not that they probably trust us right now,
right?
Especially because these tariffs could be disputed with the World Trade Organization. But it seems Trump doesn't care about the World Trade Organization, like he doesn't care about the United Nations or NATO,
right,
or the EU or pretty much anybody across the world,
right,
and respecting them. It also means that one of the major pillars of the post-war liberal world order, free trade, which is free enough, has been damaged, and we have no idea if we can fix that after Trump is gone, which
right.
I feel like a lot of these countries are, like I said, are just waiting
right.
for somebody a little bit more sane, which is why I think that China's like, maybe let's just hit them where it hurts and hit them
right.
at the ballot box and maybe help the Democrats out just a little bit, which of course we don't want people meddling in our elections, and we do want people to go to the ballot box with their and vote their conscience. But I could see China saying to themselves, like, this isn't going to work.
Right.
This guy ain't gonna work.
Right. Well, and again, I think that China's thinking isn't so much specific meddling as it is seeing an opportunity to weaken this administration and to sow some real internal ennui in Trump voters, especially.
Did you say ennui?
I did say ennui.
Ennui.
Well, and it also really shows, and this is directly from Varsha, that neither party is really proposing fair trade policy at the moment. And Democrats have historically been more protectionist than Republicans. I mean, Republicans are theoretically the party of free trade and capitalism and consumerism, and that's been a whole thing for them. They're all about free trade.
Unless you're Bernie Sanders. Democrats are too, for the most part. I mean,
true.
The Obama administration pushed
the TPP.
TPP, and,
right.
And so Hillary Clinton, and yeah.
Well, but it's just a matter of neither party is proposing solutions to this, and Trump does not understand what he's doing.
No, but he's the best deal maker
in the whole world.
Yeah. All right, Devin, let's get into some gratitude check.
All right. Well, today I am grateful for Jennifer Palmieri's book, Dear Madam President. It was beautiful and it made me cry the entire time. I just cried the whole way through it because she sets it up as an open letter to the first woman to be elected president. And she frames it with what happened during Hillary's campaign. Jennifer Palmieri, for those of you who don't know, was the director of communications for Hillary's campaign. She was the director of communications for Obama's White House. Just a very fascinating and smart woman. And she talked about her experience on the campaign trail and what she expected and what she didn't expect. And at the beginning of every section, she started with, "Dear Madam President, when you walk into the Oval Office, here is my advice." And it was such a call to arms. It was such a beautiful and unifying, like, piece of writing that just was so hopeful. You know, it's talking about this loss and the sexism that Hillary experienced on the campaign and all these things that went wrong, what they had to deal with. But at the same time, it's so hopeful because she just assumes that we'll get there and that this is just, she's just giving her advice to that first woman who breaks that highest, hardest glass ceiling. And she's the one who really got me thinking a lot about emotional vulnerability and not running as adhere to this sort of culture of masculinity and embracing things like vulnerability and a more emotional, warm-hearted approach to politics. And it was very moving.
Can't wait to read it.
It was so good.
I have so many books I have to read.
I know,
that I gotta, maybe I'll bump that up to the front.
You really should. It's really fantastic. So, all right, Drexel, what are you grateful for?
Speaking of fascinating and smart women, I posted this in the Dickwad group last night. But I was telling Devin earlier, I was like, I haven't really watched the news all that often. I really limit my time. Like, Tim is so great because I'll come in from work and he'll immediately turn it over to MSNBC just so that, like, I'm ready for Mad Al. It's like I come home from work, it's MSNBC on, and then we go right into Jeopardy because we are old gays at this point. and so I think that, but Joy Reid, over the weekend, she had posted a really pretty photo of her and her hair and makeup stylist. And she had posted not to be outdone on Instagram, not to be outdone at Glam Lux and Cynthia, who rocked the H&M for one of her shoots that came up. And then, of course, notable dickwad, Killer Mike, NRA spokesperson extraordinaire.
Right.
Posted underneath. So me doing an interview about black gun ownership with the NRA is bad, but you promoting a company that tagged a black child a monkey is good, cool, acceptable. Okay, check. And then he used the crying, the laughing emoji. To which Joy Ann Reid, she clapped back. with at Killer Mike. H&M, quote, stands for hair and makeup. Mike, the two women beside me in this pic did my hair, H, and makeup, M, for a shoot. The blouse I'm wearing is by Mauricio Ferrari, and I doubt you can buy it at the retail chain you're thinking of. I got it from the designer via stylist. And here I was thinking you were an intellectual and not just the guy who hangs out in the sunken place talking guns with the NRA's official black guy, quote unquote, who literally changed his last name to quote unquote black.
Oh, so
let me tell you who not to go after.
Right? Is it Joyanne Reed?
That's going to be Joyanne Reed.
Yeah.
We don't mess with Joyanne Reed.
No. She's
but like, why would he think that? Especially if you don't know fashion.
Right?
Well, you can't even see. I'm looking at that photo. Like, you can't even tell
what they're wearing.
Where the blouse is from.
Right.
You can't even tell what they're wearing. And so why would you think? Because if she was going to tag H&M,
right,
she would have added H&M.
Right.
She would have tagged them.
Right. No, I know. It makes no sense. Why would you do that?
Because, you know, these Sanders people, they just want to fight somebody.
Seriously.
I don't get it.
I don't get it either.
All right, Devin. Let's get into our favorite section.
It is my favorite section.
Our dickwad of the week. Speaking of silly Sanders people.
Who's our dickwad? Our dickwad this week is Saint Bernard of Sanders.
Saint Bernard of the Isle of Sanders.
So Drexel, can you tell us why Saint Bernard has the distinction, nay, dishonor, of being Dickwad of the Week this week?
Yeah, so Bernie Sanders was doing his pre-presidential run swing through the South, because we know for a fact that he did not do well with African Americans during the 2016 primaries. So he was sitting with a group of African American leaders and African Americans in the South, and speaking about kind of his typical, you know, going through his typical rhetoric, but also talking about why Democrats, of which a party he's not a part of,
still not a Democrat,
still not a Democrat. Yet talking about the Democratic Party as if he is. This was on the anniversary of MLK's assassination last week, the 50th anniversary. And he was at the town hall meeting talking about economic justice, which, yes, fine, whatever. But he criticized the business model of the Democratic Party over the last 15 years. He said that many don't see the Democratic Party's failures, many as in African Americans, because there was a charismatic individual named Barack Obama. He was obviously an extraordinary candidate, brilliant guy. He also pointed out how Democrats lost a record number of seats in the House and Senate during the Obama presidency. Now, it's one thing to highlight the failures of the party from a structural standpoint in terms of losing 1,000 legislative seats, losing the House and the Senate, and really trying to figure out how to help build that bench up. It's another thing to call the first black president just a charismatic, brilliant candidate,
right,
without following it up with an equally as brilliant and charismatic president.
Right.
Like,
yeah, it's a very important distinction.
Like, he very specifically said candidate. And I think that's a problem. And that's going to continue to sit with people in the back of their heads. I know he ended up getting a standing ovation when talking about economic justice with that group of black leaders, which makes sense because we know that African Americans get hit the most or get hit the hardest economically. And so, yeah, that part of it made sense. But somebody pointed out there's three people that you don't attack in the African-American community. Oprah, Beyonce, and Barack Obama.
Right.
You just those are kind of off limits.
Right.
In terms of there's criticism.
Right. Good faith
construction,
criticism.
Constructive criticism. And then there's just asinine criticism that just because you just want to say stuff. And there was a question that somebody asked Senator Sanders shortly afterwards about, did he learn anything from the 2016 election about his rhetoric and not being able to balance the two between economic justice and civil rights? And
he, I bet his answer was a hoot.
He did say something about like, yeah, I learned a lot. But then, of course, I think he was on the heels of this backlash that he was not expecting.
Right.
So I think that is why he gets the dickwad of the week. And of course, Barack Obama's not going to come out and be like, this guy.
this fucking guy.
He probably did. Like, at home.
At home,
and
yeah.
And was like, this motherfucker said, oh, what? Said, I'm a charismatic and brilliant candidate? Which I won twice. With triple the votes that you got in the primary.
Right.
Who do you think you're talking to? How about?
Well, you know, it's also interesting. I'm going to say interesting because that's maybe the nicest thing I could say. So St. Bernard talks a lot about economic justice, and especially in the wake of Trump's election, I feel like all the only fucking words he knows are economic justice and
anxiety.
That
wasn't since the Trump administration. That was how he is campaigned.
That's a good point. I just mean that he's really been pushing this idea that we did not court the working class, which I really think is just code for white working class. Because,
well, why don't he just say it?
But he didn't. I mean, because
I'm saying, why doesn't he just say
why
it?
Does he just
could
say
get
it?
A lot of white people to vote for him.
He really could.
A lot of white Republicans, a lot of Trump voters could vote. I mean, they're one in the same. They're crossover sometimes.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, when he was asked there about the marginalization of Black LGBTQ citizens, he flipped it to talk about, you know, he wanted to shift the question to talking about people who work two or three jobs or people who spend 50% of their income on housing.
Because he does not believe in identity politics.
Right.
He doesn't understand that there's a reason.
But wouldn't economic politics also be identity politics?
Well, no, because I'm sure in Bernie Sanders' mind, he doesn't see color.
Right.
And when you don't see color,
right,
you look at everything from an outside, like, you know, just an overall general viewpoint.
Right. Well, and so the thing is that he's looking at this idea of fighting poverty and economic injustice with no intersectional lens whatsoever. And I think that for me, like you said, calling Obama a charismatic candidate and not speaking to his presidency and flipping questions so that he talks about, you know, only this sort of economic justice message that he wants. I mean, he ignores things like the fact that Black and Latino middle class families are headed towards zero wealth. And he ignores the fact that he did poorly with Black voters for a reason. He refuses to see the sort of criticism of him and just continues to push this message that I think is really coded white.
Well, he's from Vermont. I can't imagine that there's a lot of Black people in Vermont. You know, and that's why he said, you know, backstage at the event, of course we need civil rights in this country. First of all, he said, of course we need civil rights in this country, as if it was like an aside, like, you
right.
know, he said, but we also need economic justice. Okay.
Right.
Got it. Yes, you are correct. But you need to be able to talk about them both
in
with
tandem.
A little more in depth. And targeted.
Right.
Because if you're talking to Black voters about white voters, that's not going to work.
Right.
White voters try to pretend like they don't see color, but they do.
Right.
And so if anybody out there tells you that they don't see color,
run.
Smack them and run the other way.
And we also have a quick bonus round.
Yes.
There is a representative named Representative Ralph Norman, and he is from...
Good old Alabama? No?
No. Where is he from? You know what? Who gives a fuck where he's from? Basically, what happened is he was at a coffee with your congressman at a diner, and he pulled out a loaded Smith & Wesson gun. And he said, quote, mental health and more importantly, a lack of morality is the driving force behind this epidemic. Guns are not the problem. And he went on to say, quote, he won't be a Gabby Giffords, and that if someone shot at him, he would shoot back.
Well, first of all, he's from the great state of South Carolina.
South Carolina.
I won't be a Gabby. This motherfucker said, I won't be a Gabby Giffords.
And pulled out
I'm surprised he said, I won't be a Gabby Giffords, but did not say, I won't be a Steve Scalise.
Right. Right.
You won't be a Steve Scalise?
Oh, right.
Oh, okay.
Okay, good.
If he would have said, I won't be a Gabby Giffords and a Steve Scalise, I'd have been like, it still would have been terrible,
right.
But I'd have been like, at least you're balancing the two up.
Right. This actually goes back
as if Gabby Giffords can't protect herself for some reason.
Right, exactly.
Steve Scalise couldn't either.
Right, exactly. And yeah, so, and just pulling out a loaded handgun at a meeting with constituents. What the fuck is going on? All right, Drexel, last but not least, let's do a quick action item for our listeners. So something they can do after they listen to the show. What is one thing our listeners can do this week?
You know what you can do, people?
What?
You better get those motherfuckers out there registered to vote.
Yes.
Get them to vote. Rock yes. that vote.
Yes.
Get, you know.
I know it feels early for us to bring this up.
It's never too early yep. because we don't want to go into the situation where your St. Bernard friends are like, well, we didn't know. to change our voter registration.
Exactly.
Here in California, if you are 16 to 17 and you're getting your driver's license, you are automatically registered to vote.
Yes.
And those are the policies that Republicans cannot stand.
They hate them.
And that we need to continue to push across the country.
Yes. Dean Heller of Nevada, senator from Nevada, actually said at a town hall that the registered Democrats in Nevada outnumber registered Republicans. And if that statistic holds, he can't win his reelection. Think about that. He fucking said that.
Yeah. Here in California, going back to the 16 and 17 year olds, out of the 10,000 or some odd registered 16 and 17 year olds over the past year or so, only 10% of those registered as Republicans. So only 1,000 16 or 17 year olds out of 10,000 registered Republican.
Yep.
That doesn't mean they registered Democrat, but that certainly doesn't mean that they registered Republican.
Exactly.
So that's something that Republicans are starting to probably recognize. Not that they look at California because we only have so many electoral votes.
Right.
However, that's something that we need to continue to push. And I know that a lot of these, you know, even with like Black Panther, a lot of these events have started to utilize their events not only as premieres, but also voter registration
yep.
drives.
Yep.
So if you're doing an event, say you're hosting a birthday party or yep. you're doing something, use that motherfucker also as a voter registration guide because you've got the audience. And if people aren't registered, then you need to get those bitches registered.
It's so true. And again, we're probably preaching to the converted a little bit here. Sure, most of you Helens are already registered, but get your friends, your family, your neighbor.
Dog.
There's a Facebook thing where you can post and people can click directly the link and it just shows them how to register to vote. It's really quick. It's really simple. And I know it's a lot of paperwork, but you got to get your like, driver's license out. You got to do all this stuff. But like, it's obviously worth it.
It's obviously worth it. Yeah. And like I said, it may feel a little bit early, but you know, once you put it off a couple of times, all of a sudden it's November and you're totally fucked.
And it's not even just November.
Primaries are coming up.
June. As my wedding is coming up, is right around the corner here in California. We've got a June primary for governor.
Yep. So,
this shit's coming up, and yep. you don't want your friends out there being like I said, I didn't know that it was coming up.
Exactly. So get out there and register to vote because you know what? When we vote, we fucking win. Democrats win. When people vote, Democrats win.
Yes. Or as Barack Obama says, don't boo.
Vote. All right, Drexel, that does it for us. We have a very exciting show on Thursday with the legendary Cecile Richards.
Tell her I said hello.
I will. And Drexel and I will be back here on Monday. Thank you so much for listening.
Ciao.